Hi, I'm Dan Lothian, the executive producer for The World. I want to take a moment to extend a heartfelt thank you to everyone who has donated to The World's fall fundraiser so far. Thank you. We are able to produce the best in international reporting with the highest production value because of listeners like you who stepped up to support The World financially. This drive is critically important in sustaining our reporting year-round. Recurring gifts are especially impactful. They ensure we have the resources to be meaningful with our time, to ask consequential questions, and to dive deep into hard issues. It allows us to plan ahead so we can spend more time thinking about the coverage we'd like to bring you next week, next month, and even next year. We are aiming to raise $67,000 before the end of the year, and a generous donor has offered to match your gift one for one. Every gift gets us closer to our goal. Can we count on you? Please visit theworld.org/give to double your impact today. That's theworld.org/give. Once again, thank you. And now the show.
Support for this podcast comes from Wise, the account that lets you send, spend, and receive money internationally. Wise is the best way to move and manage your money around the world, all with one account. It's for saving in dollars, pesos, baht, and more. It's for sending money back home fast and makes vacation spending in the local currency simple. You'll always get the mid-market exchange rate when you convert currencies, with no markups and no hidden fees. It's one account built for your international life. Join 15 million customers and learn how the Wise account could work for you by downloading the app or visiting wise.com/world.
Two months of war between Israel and Hamas have yielded a troubling level of violence and destruction. The regional economy is also taking a hit.
I had a car, I had to sell it. I had a house, I sold it. Many things, I have a piece of land also that I sold, so it wasn't easy.
I'm Marco Werman. Also today, ramping up dependence on renewable energy. It can be done quickly. Just ask the people on this island in the Atlantic.
Dentro de la mentalidad del herreño,
we fend for ourselves, he says. It is our mentality. And in India, religious laws upheld by the court system give clergy and religious leaders a lot of power.
The clergy as a class is, you know, resistant towards any reform.
But the system might be changing. All that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. It's good to have you with us today. The COP28 Global Climate Summit is expected to wrap up next week. UN Climate Chief Simon Steele gave negotiators this mandate before the summit in Dubai broke today for a day of rest.
At the end of next week, we need COP to deliver a bullet train to speed up climate action. We currently have an old caboose chugging over rickety tracks. But the tools are all there on the table.
One of those tools is a proposal for an international pledge to triple renewable energy capacity by 2030. That's a little over 6 years away and obviously would be a big deal. We wanted to see what that looks like to quickly ramp up reliance on renewables. So we sent our reporter Jerry Haddon to the Spanish island of El Hierro in the Canaries. This is a place that a decade ago used zero renewable energy. Today, people there get about half their energy from renewables. Jerry reports on what makes the island especially good for this kind of transformation and how much of what these islanders learned could be applied elsewhere.
In a courtyard in a small coastal village, an arts event celebrating El Hierro's volcanic heritage is burning through a lot of power. There's a big, brightly lit, translucent cube with a dancer inside. Next to that, a slideshow of volcanic landscapes. Then there's this sound system playing music. All of it's running at night. No one here seems to be thinking about where all this electricity comes from, probably because El Hierro has that more than covered by these. Wind turbines, 200 feet tall, their white blades spinning high up on a ridge over the Atlantic. The island has five of them. They stand at the center of a renewable energy project aimed at ridding the island entirely of fossil fuels. It's called Corona del Viento, a public-private outfit with funding from Spain, the European Union, and Spanish electricity giant Endesa. Spokeswoman Cristina Morales says the turbines generate up to 11.5 megawatts of electricity. That's more than the island needs. The turbines send half of that juice to consumers. As for the rest,
¿qué hacemos con el resto, con lo que nos sobra? Elevamos agua del depósito inferior al superior.
We use it to pump desalinated water, Morales says, 2,500 cubic liters per hour from a low reservoir up to another high on the mountainside. Then we release that water down through turbines, she says. This generates whatever electricity shortfall we might have. On a good day, between wind and water, the system can provide 100% of the island's electricity. On days when there's little wind, they can release more stored water, ramping up hydropower to compensate. If the wind stops altogether, the upper reservoir can keep El Hierro's lights on for up to 3 days. Corona says it has reduced El Hierro's dependence on diesel-powered electricity by half in its decade of operation. There are some unique ingredients here that have made this possible, starting with the people. Local councilman Antonio Chinea sits on Corona's board. He says ideas for self-reliance tend to resonate with El Hierro's roughly 10,000 residents. He says it's in their DNA.
Dentro de la mentalidad del herreño, como te decía anteriormente, está.
We have long had a fend-for-ourselves mentality, he says, being so isolated out at sea. There are times when planes and boats cannot reach us due to bad weather, and we have to get by on our own. The renewables plan was not only instantly popular, there was lots of money for it, from multiple funders who saw the island as a sort of test case. And then there was the wind, the consistent easterlies known as the alisios. It all added up to a perfect mix that seemed to put total reliance on renewables within reach. But then, a couple of years ago, the alisios began slowing down. There's barely a breeze right now, says Chinea. It's not normal for this time of year. It's hot and there's hardly any wind. These periods of still air are becoming more frequent, he says, which causes wind energy and thus hydropower to drop. Corona officials and locals blame the decreasing winds on what this whole renewables project was set up to combat, climate change. Inside Corona's hydroelectric station, six huge red pumps stand at the ready. But that sound, it's just the cooling fans. Many days have passed without enough wind to wake these giants. I'm not pessimistic about the future, says Corona's Cristina Morales, but as a company, we do need to start adapting to these planetary changes. Now that the winds are calming, Corona is pivoting. The public-private partnership overseeing El Hierro's energy transition is offering big subsidies for solar panels, encouraging individuals to install them on their homes. With each panel, the demand on Corona's lagging energy plant lessens. Solar panels installer Marco Sanchez says he's crushed under orders. In fact, to meet strict timelines attached to subsidies, he says he's forced to leave some installations nearly finished, then come back to button things up later. That's what he's doing today. This installation works, he says, climbing up to a six-panel setup on a client's garage roof. But look, he says, those dangling cables shouldn't be visible. They're carrying 700 volts of current. If something goes wrong here, he says, it could be catastrophic. You'd lose the panels, I say? No, he says, for you, you'd lose your life. Once done here, Sanchez speeds off to his next job in his diesel truck. The island has transportation in its sights as well. Corona now subsidizes electric vehicles. People are snapping them up and charging them for free at new stations around the island. On a recent lunch break, local travel agent Divinia Carballo unplugs her red Opel Corsa from a station near her office. She says the island desperately needs more charging points. Currently, there are only about a dozen. And she says people need to learn some renewable energy etiquette.
Hay gente que lo enchufa a las 9 de la noche o tal y no lo desenchufa hasta.
There are people, she says, who plug in their car at a public charger in the evening and don't unplug it until the morning. You need to be a little bit aware, she says, that other people are waiting to charge up too. Small inconveniences aside, Carballo says the island's transition to renewables in recent years has given people hope and a sense of purpose. But the worry remains. Are the diminishing winds a temporary blip or a lasting consequence of a warming planet? What's clear is that El Hierro, and any place seeking to emulate it, must have diversified energy sources to keep the power flowing consistently and be ready to adapt to whatever climate change might throw its way. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, El Hierro, the Canary Islands, Spain.
It has been 2 months of war for people in the Gaza Strip. Currently, there's heavy fighting in and around the southern Gaza city of Khan Yunis. And once again, thousands of people have been forced away to seek safety. Many had already left their homes in other parts of the Palestinian territory. But the United Nations says that now shelters in the south are at capacity and that displaced people are forced to live on the streets. James Elder is a spokesperson with the UN's Emergency Children's Fund, UNICEF. He's in Gaza now.
The only safety in Gaza is for the hell to stop raining down from the sky.
Many parts of the globe, but especially Israel's neighbors in the Middle East, are calling for a ceasefire. As the war enters its third month, the region is feeling the impact in different ways, and that includes economic effects. The World's Shirin Jafari reports from Amman, Jordan, on one industry that's been hit hard, tourism.
On the outskirts of Amman are the ancient Roman ruins of Jarash. It's one of the best-preserved Roman cities, where back in the day, gladiators competed in chariot racing contests as spectators watched from the stone seats. Dirar Atmet grew up around here.
When I used to come and, you know, see people come in, tourists, I said, this is my thing, you know, this is where I should go, you see.
Atmet has been working as a tour guide in Jordan for the past 2 decades. He says nothing brings him more joy than telling foreign visitors about the long history and the splendor of this site. But these are tough times for Atmet and thousands of others who work in the tourism industry in Jordan and neighboring countries. The war in Gaza has brought his business to a near standstill, he says.
I lost 80% of my job. I mean, 80% of my reservations were canceled.
Tours from Europe, the US, and Australia were cancelled one after the other. People stopped coming.
It's very frightening for them, you know.
As we walk around the Roman ruins, he tells me about his 5 kids back home. He says he's struggling to provide for them. For Atme, what's happening now brings back difficult memories of the early days of the pandemic when he lost most of his assets.
I had a car, I had to sell it. I had a house, I sold it. Many things. I have a piece of land also that I sold, so it wasn't easy.
Atma says he's worried about the weeks and months ahead, as there seems to be no end in the fighting. Jordan's unemployment rate as of last year was about 23%, according to the World Bank. If tourists don't come back, he says, it's not like he can find another job easily. Tours here are typically part of a package that includes Jordan, Israel, and Egypt. Conflict in one of them means people cancel their whole trip. Ben Julius is the founder of Tourist Israel, one of the largest tour agencies in Israel.
From the beginning of the war, we saw an immediate drop to close to zero from what was expecting to be one of the best and busiest periods ever.
In Israel, things have improved a bit now, but after October 7th, flights were cancelled, tourist sites were closed, and hotels were empty.
It's been very difficult for us. Around 70% of our team, we immediately had to send to furlough again. Many of them only came back into the tourism industry and back into the company in the last year because of the recovery from COVID.
Julius operates tours in Egypt as well, and he says they've had many cancellations there too. In Lebanon, the Christmas season is also shaping up to be a loss this year. Julius is seeing signs of improvement for next year. He says people are booking their trips in advance.
That's giving us a little bit of hope going into next year.
Meanwhile, back in Jordan, the Minister of Tourism, Makram Mustafa Qaisi, predicts an even bigger drop in the number of tourists in the coming months if the war doesn't stop.
The problem is that people in the West and elsewhere, actually, when they look at the map, they don't differentiate between Jordan and the neighboring countries. People don't understand that we are not in a war zone.
He tells me he wants to change that perception and help people understand that Jordan is a safe place to visit. When tourists don't come, he says, that affects a whole swath of the economy.
We talk about the bus drivers, for example. We speak about restaurants. We speak about hotels. We speak about the tour operators and the people who work with the tour operators.
For tourism to survive, he says, this region needs stability and security.
This aggression has to stop because at the end of the day, there's no winner.
In the meantime, Jordan is using this unexpected break in tourism to renovate some of its historical sites. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari, Jarash, Jordan.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Hamas, the Palestinian militant group, has been in control of the Gaza Strip going back to 2007. The leadership structure of Hamas is hard to map out. Some live in Gaza. Many live in exile, like in Qatar. They're also in Lebanon, Syria, and Turkey. Inside the Gaza Strip, the commanders of the military wing of Hamas are believed to be hiding from Israeli airstrikes in underground tunnels. Wherever they are, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has said that all of Hamas's leadership will be hunted down and killed. Ali Hashem is a correspondent who's covered the Middle East for 20 years and interviewed the leaders of Hamas. He's also a correspondent for Al Monitor. Big picture here, Ali, when you think of Hamas, how would you draw an organizational chart for them? Like, who is at the top and what does that structure look like?
For Hamas, it's not the typical structure for an organization because there is several decision, let me say, councils. So you have the main Shura Council that oversees everything, and this is chosen by the main members of the group. Now, this Shura Council is the one that appoints the head of the Politburo. The Politburo is the leadership of the organization. Now, the Politburo, mainly its leaders, Ismail Haniyeh, who is the chief of the Politburo, is based currently in Qatar, and also others, his deputy, Saleh Al-Arouri, is based in Lebanon. However, there is also another parallel structure within Hamas, which is the military structure or the Azzedine Al-Qassam Brigades. And this is under the whole organization, but it takes its own decisions kind of independently. And this structure, the Azzedine Al-Qassam military wing, is led by Mohammed al-Dayef. Mohammed al-Dayef is a Palestinian from Khan Yunis, which is also in Gaza. Now, in the past, when the leadership was based in Gaza, there was a direct connection between the Politburo and the Azzedine Qassam leadership. But since the leadership became outside, things started changing gradually. And now the Politburo became mainly commissioned to do negotiations on behalf of whoever is in Gaza.
What Hamas leaders were behind the attack on October 7th? Do we even know for sure?
Mohammed al-Dayef, the commander-in-chief of Al-Qassam Brigades, he is the one who gave a speech on the day, on the 7th of October, and announced the attack, announced the details of what was happening. Also, Yahya Sinwar, the leader of Hamas in Gaza. So these are the main two men behind the attacks. Of course, what Israel wants currently is to hit the core of the Al-Qassam Brigades, because by hitting the military wing of Hamas, mainly in Gaza, a main part of this organization, it will be neutralized. And then maybe the second step would be starting to targeting the political leaders of the organization.
Is it possible that Hamas's Politburo abroad did not know the attacks of October 7th were in the works?
Well, they didn't know. They didn't know. Most of the officials that we spoke to said they didn't know about it.
And what does that tell us? Does that suggest there is any internal dissent in the leadership, like the Al-Qassam Brigades versus leadership abroad?
There is actually a kind of an independent decision-making within the military wing. They can take decisions on their own. And this is not the first time. On several occasions, they took certain decisions that the political wing had to deal with.
So the way Hamas has parts that function independently, meaning that leadership can't necessarily stop Al-Qassam Brigades from doing something ultimately politically destructive, is that the case?
Well, of course, yes, of course. And I'll give you another example. Main part of the political leadership of Hamas didn't want to get into better relations with Iran. The military wing saw that without strong relations with Syria and Iran, this group is not going to be able to continue. So the military wing had to pressure the political wing to restore relations and to have a rapprochement with the Iranians and later on with the Syrians.
Interesting. What do you know about which Hamas leaders are currently active in daily governance operations and where they are?
Well, in fact, you know, the Politburo chief, Ismail Haniyeh, is the man who is calling the shots outside. But of course, there are several other main officials, or let me say main characters within the group, such as Saleh Al-Aruri, the deputy Politburo chief, who lives in Lebanon, Osama Hamdan, who is also one of the main faces over the past years. He's been always instrumental in the political decision-making process. Also, Khalil Al-Hayya, who used to be in Gaza, and I met him, I interviewed him several times. He is now also, I think, in Beirut. These are the main personalities within the group outside Gaza. While in Gaza, the situation is different for now. I mean, before the war, it was Yahya Sinwar mainly. He was the face of Hamas in Gaza. Also, you have Al-Qassam, as we said, Muhammad Al-Dif, he's the commander general. It's a group full of names. It's a group full of actors within it, such as Khaled Mish'al. Khaled Mish'al is the leader of Hamas abroad. This is another position within the group.
So we've got all these Hamas leaders abroad. And when you hear Prime Minister Netanyahu essentially say he's going to assassinate them all, what do you make of that? Like, what would it mean if Israeli intelligence starts picking off these leaders in other countries? Permission be damned.
Well, this is going to create real troubles, because you have Qatar, which is a very strong ally of the United States, a strategic ally of the United States. And you have Turkey, the NATO member, and also another regional power. If Israel is to assassinate in Turkey and in Qatar, of course, we had the Turks a couple of days ago leaking to Anadolu news agency, their own national news agency, that they are warning Israel of doing any kind of assassinations for Hamas leaders on Turkish soils. So this is a clear warning. However, if Israel is going to target Hamas members or leaders in Lebanon, the situation already on the Lebanese-Israeli border is escalating, and there's tension, and there's a daily exchange. So this could add, of course, to the tension there. It's not going to be a walk in the park.
I mean, we've heard from several experts on our show that Hamas as a movement cannot be destroyed through military action, because it's more than people and soldiers. It's an idea. I'm wondering if you see the months ahead as the end of Hamas as we've known it for the last couple of decades.
Maybe in Gaza, things are going to be different, given the fact that the destruction that took place till the moment. But the problem is that we don't see the end game. So if Israel wasn't able to destroy Hamas, how things are going to be run in Gaza? Who is going to call the shots in Gaza? How is Hamas going to come back overground after being underground for the past 2 months? These are big questions. I don't have answers for.
Journalist Ali Hashem has reported extensively in the Middle East, including interviews with Hamas leaders. Thank you very much for helping us understand the organizational structure of Hamas, Ali. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
More stories from around the globe still coming your way this hour. You're listening to The World. He spent years preparing, knew he was risking his own life by going to one of the most isolated places on earth to proselytize.
Was John possessed of a powerful faith, a noble faith, or was John out of his mind? And I think the answer is probably both.
The story of a young American missionary's ill-fated journey to an island in the Bay of Bengal, ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. As far as data breaches go, it is not the biggest, but it is a very personal one. Nearly 7 million people are said to be affected by the hack of the genealogy tracking company 23andMe. It happened in early October and goes far beyond U.S. borders. In Canada, a class action lawsuit has been filed against a company by local customers.
You get an email that says, oh, hey, you've been breached. And you're like, oh, no. Like, it's just such a horrible emptiness that you're that vulnerable out there.
That's an anonymous 23andMe customer speaking with the CBC. To understand more about this data breach, we're speaking with reporter Lorenzo Franceschi Bicchieri. He broke the story for TechCrunch and joins us from New York. What do we know, Lorenzo, about this hack into 23andMe?
So what we know is that sometime this year, hackers broke into the accounts of 14,000 customers of 23andMe. The way the hackers broke into the accounts of these 14,000 people, according to the company, is by using a technique called credential stuffing. Essentially, what this means is that the hackers take a known password for somebody. Maybe it came out in another data breach in the past, and they just try that password, hoping that the customer reuses passwords across accounts, which unfortunately is still pretty common. By doing that, they broke into all these accounts, and because of a feature called DNA relatives, they were also able to then see the information of many, many more customers. So instead of just 14,000 victims, there were actually almost 7 million.
So do we know who hacked 23andMe?
Right now, we have no idea. The way that the world found out about this data breach was that a hacker on a well-known hacking forum publicized what they alleged was stolen data from 23andMe. The hacker on the hacking forum wanted to sell it. They were trying to sell individual accounts for $1 to $10. They were essentially trying to monetize this any way they could. We have no idea if they were able to. There were also some sort of racial undertones to the initial post.
Explain that. What do you mean?
Yeah, the sample that the hackers posted to prove that they had some data was on Ashkenazi Jews. And, you know, this was like right before the terrorist attack in Israel. And obviously, you know, anti-Semitism is always an issue. We don't know why the hackers chose that. But, you know, the implication is somebody could identify Ashkenazi Jews or people with other descents that are minorities that are discriminated against and use this information against them in some way.
So in this massive hack, what kind of data was stolen and how compromising could that be?
For the 7 million people, there's also a lot of personal data, like their display name, relationship labels, the relationship and percentage of DNA shared with their relatives, their location, ancestors' birth location and family names, profile pictures, birth year, all kinds of very personal information that while it may be, you know, we're not talking about credit card numbers, social security numbers that could have like, you know, a financial impact on the victims. It's still like very personal data that people could use in ways that maybe we don't even know. You know, the obvious one is someone could pretend to be somebody's relative, send an email asking for like money, some sort of scam, some sort of fraud by impersonating these victims or their relatives.
So what would you say is the significance of this hack into this particular company, 23andMe? What makes it different from other hacks?
You know, people use 23andMe and other genetic testing companies to find out about their past, find out about who they are, where they come from. And by having this data stolen, I think it feels like a very big privacy breach. It's very personal. Victims have trusted 23andMe with a lot of personal information, something that's like very sensitive, very personal. And they're just angry. I think, you know, they thought that this was going to tell them something about their past, something about their identity. And now somebody out there, we have no idea who, has all this data.
Lorenzo, for many people, 23andMe has provided pathways to knowing identity. It's also answered important questions, even life-saving ones about inherited disease, for example. Do you think this hack is going to make people hesitant in using DNA services like 23andMe?
I think so. I've seen people already arguing that people should not be using these services. The main argument is not just that they may not be very good at keeping this information safe, as this data breach suggests, but also that people are just entrusting these companies that are for-profit companies with a lot of information, with very personal information. And sometimes we just don't know where this information is going to end up.
Lorenzo Franceschi Bicchiera is a reporter with TechCrunch. He joined us from New York. Thank you very much for helping us understand this better.
Thanks for having me. My pleasure.
In India, civil matters like marriage, divorce, and inheritance fall under religious laws that differ across faiths. They're called personal laws, and the court system recognizes them legally. But Prime Minister Narendra Modi, who is up for re-election next year, wants a common law system for all. Many Indians say this violates religious freedoms. Others feel that some of these personal laws uphold misogyny and need to go. From Delhi, reporter Sushmita Pathak has more.
Zakia Soman was in an abusive marriage for 16 years until she decided to run away. But she didn't immediately file for divorce. She felt that personal laws for Indian Muslims put her at a disadvantage.
Even if I seek divorce, I have to seek it from my ex. And that would lead to all kinds of demands from him.
She got divorced eventually and became an activist for Muslim women's rights. But even today, she sees women going through what she went through.
You know, all these women who come to us, they will say, leave your children, ask your father to write off the property in my name. Those kind of demands all these men make.
Indian Muslims are governed by rules laid down in Islamic holy texts. The Quran is fair to women, she says. But the problem is that Muslim personal law, unlike laws of other faiths, is not codified.
We are pretty much ruled by oral interpretations, or rather misinterpretations, as per the, you know, understanding of the local clergy in different parts of the country. Whatever they say is the law is the law.
Rules about divorce and practices like polygamy aren't clearly defined in the Muslim personal law in India. As a result, she says, Muslim women are suffering. This is a point that Prime Minister Modi and his party, the BJP, raise again and again. Hindu nationalists frame the Uniform Civil Code as a way to end regressive Muslim customs.
The Uniform Civil Code fundamentally is about gender justice and gender equality. But now when the BJP rakes it up and when the Prime Minister talks about it, of course it is part of his politics.
Since coming to power in 2014, the BJP has often used religion to influence voters, says Sanjay Kumar at the Center for the Study of Developing Societies in Delhi. Uniform Civil Code is a part of that tactic.
This is being used as a tool for political mobilization.
Modi has described the existing system as being similar to having different rules for different members of a family. For example, Hindu families get special tax benefits, and Muslim men can have multiple wives. And the rules are part of the legal system. The country cannot progress like this, Modi said. Uniform Civil Code has been one of the BJP's three main promises. The other two were building a Hindu temple in northern India to replace a mosque destroyed in 1992 and revoking the autonomy of Muslim-majority Kashmir. Those two promises have been met. Only the Uniform Code remains.
It is being referred by Prime Minister time and again to just remind the people that this is one big issue. We need to work hard. So you have to vote us so that we are able to come back to power.
Modi and his party insist a Uniform Code will bring justice to women. But some gender equality activists say there's a better way to do it. Audrey DeMello is a women's rights lawyer specializing in family law.
We all should work towards equality within law and not uniformity of the law.
That means improving existing laws within each community. Two decades ago, DeMello was involved in bringing about an amendment that made it easier for Christian women to get a divorce.
Because it was done with the support of the community, because it was done with consensus, it was not opposed. Change has to come like that.
Indians are deeply religious, and imposing a common law is doomed to fail, she says. India is also very diverse. A uniform law will be opposed by tribal groups and other minorities too. It will go against the country's pluralism, she says. And the real problem is not the laws. It's access to justice, DeMello says.
Whether it's property, whether it's matrimonial disputes, whether it's something as serious and abusive as domestic violence, women find it very difficult to go against their families and communities and go to court and fight.
Those supporting a uniform code will also be seen as going against their community. Zakia Soman, the Muslim women's activist, knows this all too well. She's been accused of being a Hindu nationalist. She too would prefer reform within Muslim personal law and to have it codified. But she doesn't see that happening.
The clergy as a class is, you know, resistant towards any reform. Because the moment you talk about reform, they say that Sharia is in danger, Islam is in danger. I would say I'm hopeless. You know, I have no hope.
She says the sad part is that amid the political tussle, women's rights have been sidelined. Ahead of elections next year, political observers say the Uniform Civil Code will continue to come up in politicians' speeches and rallies, but any change will only come after the vote. For The World, I'm Sushmita Pathak in Delhi.
Italy's love and devotion to opera, the country's extraordinary roster of composers over the centuries, and its artists like the late great tenor Luciano Pavarotti have all led the United Nations Cultural Agency to declare Italian opera intangible cultural heritage, now protected by UNESCO's mandate. Opera in Italy has evolved across four centuries with a compelling mix of music, voice, costume, and drama. This is Pavarotti in 1983 at the height of his powers, performing the aria Nessun Dorma from Puccini's opera Turandot at the famed La Scala Theater in Milan. The eight nights of the Jewish festival of Hanukkah start this evening. For many Jews around the world, the war between Israel and Hamas is top of mind right now. The conflict in the Middle East is also stoking anti-Semitism in many countries. Andrea Commons is a writer, teacher, and mom from Pittsburgh. She remembers the worst anti-Semitic attack in U.S. history. It happened in her hometown on October 27, 2018. This is a part of Andrea Commons' story, as told to GBH's Stories from the Stage.
The most famous of contrary Jewish opinions in the Talmud comes from Rabbi Hillel and Rabbi Shammai. Hillel got to be popular, became associated with inclusiveness and love, and Shammai more with being technical and legal, high standards. These guys argued about everything. And the principle was they were both right, but that we practiced according to the opinions of Hillel. What? Jewish practice is the embodiment of Jewish law, and law is supposed to care about what's right. And for me, Shammai was even more often right, especially when I was a kid, especially for the holiday of Hanukkah. On Hanukkah, we light candles, one the first night, two the second night, all the way up to eight, to recall a little cruise of oil that lasted for 8 days when we miraculously reclaimed our holy temple from the Syrian Greeks in ancient Israel. No, says Shammai, the oil decreased every day. It should be like a countdown, 8, 7, 6. Hillel said, yeah, but more light equals more happiness, and every day should be happier and brighter and more holy than the day before. When I first heard this, when I was growing up in Cleveland, Ohio, I told my parents I was lighting according to sensible Shammai. And for 3 years, I lit backwards. It's the last night of Hanukkah, and all our menorahs are set out. My parents, my brothers, my sisters, on the glass-topped coffee table in the living room by the big front window. They had 8 candles in each menorah and the extra one, the shamash, the helper candle, right in the middle. And there was mine. I had a helper and one defiant candle. This past Shabbos, Saturday morning, I walked an hour in the rain to a family friend's bar mitzvah. I got there in time to hear him read the Torah and give his talk on, of all things, Hillel and Shammai, and what it really means to be generous and expansive with our hospitality and how to meet the other, 13-year-old kid. He was called Giggles and Sunshine, and his dad gave him this blessing from a famous Jewish saying that you should receive every person with an open face, a smile. And he credited the source, and it was logical Rabbi Shammai. After Shabbat, we found out that the largest anti-Semitic massacre in American history had happened. 11 Jews were killed in a synagogue less than a mile from where I was born. I didn't have my phone, so I was still with the bar mitzvah family. I borrowed a teenager's cell phone to call my mom. When I couldn't reach her right away, I started to run through all the people and where they might have been at that time on a Sabbath morning. So everyone was physically safe, and everyone knew someone. I couldn't keep scrolling through the news, so I asked a friend to text me the list when it came out. And the ages, the types of people, they weren't a surprise, because they were the stalwarts of any synagogue. The ones who come early are usually older or have special needs. They greet you at the door and pass out books and lollipops and sweep up afterwards and make sure that nobody prays alone. We call it a shamash, a caretaker, but also that same word for the helper candle. that we use on Hanukkah. We forget that it's actually dangerous to be a helper, to greet everyone with an open face when some people don't want me to exist, to make today more holy than the days before. It's audacious. Hillel and Shammai both, whether it was the first night or the last, had that one candle. Except when I tried to remember my solitary Shammai candle reflected in the window, I couldn't see it because it had never been just one. It was surrounded by the light from all the candles that my family had lit beside me. I still like the technicalities and the details that I got from Shammai. Law should be about what's right. But the place where Hillel and Shammai agree is that what's right is that we take care of each other.
That's writer and teacher and mother, Andrea Commons. She was a guest on Stories from the Stage, produced by the World TV Channel at GBH. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. North Sentinel Island in the Bay of Bengal is arguably the most isolated, inhabited place on Earth. The Sentinelese are a hunter-gatherer society. They essentially have zero contact with the outside world. But 5 years ago, a young American made it his mission to go to their island and convert them to Christianity.
I plan on arriving on the shores of an island in which an unknown number of people live, who have unknown religious beliefs and speak an unknown tongue. Some have called this the most difficult and impossible place to reach on Earth. Lord, is this island Satan's last stronghold?
The words there of John Chow, read by an actor in the new film, The Mission. Jesse Moss directed the film along with Amanda McBain. Jesse joins us to talk about The Mission. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Marco.
It is really eye-opening to see a story about missionary work, which happens a lot around the globe, and the general public knows very little about it. But this is an extraordinary version of the missionary story that a lot of listeners will probably remember from the news. It happened in 2018. What did you hope to accomplish by retelling it in this feature-length documentary?
Well, John's death on North Sentinel Island did capture for a moment the world's attention. Why did this young man travel to this remote island? Why did he think he could convert this tribe? And who are the Sentinelese? We felt that there was a much more complex story, that John was not a suicidal zealot, but actually part of a larger missionary movement. And we wanted to unpack that and also understand the people he came in contact with.
So as viewers, we know going in that John Chow will die on North Sentinel Island. Your film shows how events in his life lead up to that. How did you choose which events to build your narrative around this kind of look at missionary work?
Digging into John's life was difficult. His community is closed off. And in fact, John was something of a secret agent. He was planning in secret to do this. He knew that it was illegal. So it took a lot of digging and patience to build the trust of people around John, his friends, his teachers, his missionary accomplices, and then digging up some secretive plans that John himself created as he prepared for 10 years to undertake this almost impossible and ultimately fatal mission.
So the training that he got at this missionary boot camp, All Nations in Kansas, how aware were John Chow's trainers that he would be violating a travel ban because, per the Indian government, North Sentinel Island is off limits, or maybe bringing disease to the people on North Sentinel Island?
Very few organizations would support John. All Nations was one of the few that said, we're interested. And they asked themselves, does John Chow have a messiah complex? And decided he did not, that he was thoughtful, intelligent. This was not an impulsive act. This was 10 years of planning, and they decided to support him with training. As you say, in Kansas City, they ran him through a missions boot camp in which he role-played contact with this indigenous community. Was that effective? I'm not sure. Nonetheless, it gave John and All Nations the confidence that he might succeed.
So you speak with someone else who traveled to this isolated population on North Sentinel Island, and that's historian Adam Goodhart. Here's something he says late in the film that has particular resonance.
There are only so many ways for us to approach an island full of unknown people who may want to kill us. But I knew enough not to push in. I knew that nobody was going to come save me. Whereas I suppose John Chow felt that he was in the palm of the Lord's hand somehow. There's a fine line between faith and madness.
Yeah, that quote really stood out, a fine line between faith and madness. How do you think, Jesse, that applied to John Chow?
It's a powerful question. I think we leave the audience with responsibility of adjudicating. Was John possessed of a powerful faith, a noble faith, or was John out of his mind? And I think the answer is probably both. This was not a, on some level, a rational act, but it's, as one of John's teachers describes it, similar to other radical acts of faith and missions work that have been done for two millennia. And what's particularly revelatory is John's own diary, which survived him. He left it on the boat that was transporting him to this island. And it gives us insight into his radical faith, his heart, his anguish, his realization that he might die or he might survive and live there for the rest of his life. Mm. You know, John was living out a kind of fantasy, believing that he could live among them, that they would receive him. And I think one of the discoveries of the film for us is that, you know, John took in these both religious stories, but also secular stories of adventure and exploration, stories that National Geographic magazine or National Geographic, our partner in the film, have themselves promoted for over a century. And these sometimes romantic, fanciful stories, I think, are deserving of their own reckoning.
Mm. So picking up on that, National Geographic, the media giant, backed your film. Nat Geo has been accused of exoticizing groups of people like the Sentinelese in its coverage and its magazine from decades past. What conversations did you have with National Geographic as you developed your film project?
National Geographic had actually supported an expedition to North Sentinel Island in 1974, and some of the most powerful imagery of the Sentinelese we know from that magazine feature. They are engaged in a reckoning with their own history, as are we as a country, and they were committed to an honest conversation. They told us at the beginning of the project they weren't afraid to look at their own history and responsibility, and we took them at their word, and we do look at that history. And I think it belongs in this conversation. You know, John is singular and exceptional in his radical faith, but he's also representative of us and certain colonial attitudes that we have carried with us. This small story is actually part of a much larger conversation that we as a culture and as a country need to be having.
Yeah, let me just push you on that a little bit, returning to John Chow's own story. I mean, a lot has been made in recent years in the general reassessment of history of the so-called doctrine of discovery, this papal decree made by Pope Alexander VI in 1493, basically giving explorers permission to go out there in the world and convert everyone you see to Christianity. John Chow's story, his fantasy, as you call it, feels like an extreme sports version of that. But fundamentally, is that what he was attempting to do with the last remaining place one could do that in the 21st century?
The historian Adam Goodhart in our film, who tells us so much about what we know about the Sentinelese, he describes John's story as really the final page of this 500-year history. And I think that's one of the reasons why I think John's story and his death captured the world's imagination. There was an awareness that it signaled the end of this misguided, catastrophic kind of impulse to spread faith and our sort of enlightenment to the world. John believed that he was going to write on a blank page and that the Sentinelese had no history in a way, that they were there waiting to receive him. And that is absolutely not true. In fact, Adam Goodhart talks about the British colonial administrator of the Andaman Islands, where North Sentinel is located, who wrote a magisterial 1,000-page history about the tribes that live there, but also his own effort to, in some cases, kidnap them. And I think that is the kind of colonial history which John was not fully aware of and which they carried the Sentinelese into this moment of contact.
Extraordinary story. Jesse Moss directed The Mission along with Amanda McBain. It's in theaters now and will stream on Disney Plus and Hulu starting tomorrow. Jesse, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Marco.
The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.
Hi there. Just a moment before you go. We know that there are so many competing requests for your time and resources right now, especially as we head toward the end of the year. So thank you for being with us day in and day out as we deliver the best in international journalism with nuance and care. We are grateful to count you among our listeners. Your notes of support are a bright spot in our day. Thank you. If you haven't yet, there is still time to give. And as we head into 2024, your support is more important than ever. So if you can, I hope you'll make your gift today at theworld.org/give. That's theworld.org /give. Thank you so much.